Pretty much every morning you wake up and open your phone and think to yourself, I wonder if this roiling fight on the right is still ongoing, the fight over who's a Nazi and who's Nazi adjacent and who should be platformed and who should be deplatformed. That fight, the one that has mesmerized X users across the world. What is that fight actually about and how long will it continue? Well, the first thing to know about it is that it didn't start 3 weeks ago with Nick Fuentes' appearance on a podcast. No, this has been a fight taking place mostly behind the scenes since January. And that tells you a lot about what it's actually about. So here's how it began. Donald Trump inaugurated January 22nd of this year. Almost immediately after, he is visited at the White House by the first head of state to come to Washington, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. And the visit is not simply a congratulatory visit. They're not actually allies in any sense. Remember that Benjamin Netanyahu is one of the very first to congratulate Joe Biden after the 2020 election. So there's probably not a lot of warmth there, just guessing. No, there was a purpose to the visit and the subsequent visits by the Prime Minister of Israel to Washington. And that was to get American support for a regime change war in Iran to overthrow and replace the government of Iran, which the nation of Israel sees as its primary regional threat. Iran has all kinds of very dangerous conventional weapons. The United States spends a lot protecting Israel from those missiles. And Israel is also concerned that at some point, Iran will either make.
Welcome to Pod Summarizer. Visit our website and summarize your favorites podcasts.
Or buy a nuclear weapon, leaving Israel no longer the only nuclear-armed nation in the region. So that's what it's actually about. And to be honest, you can see from Israel's point of view, if you're trying to identify long-term serious threats to you, Iran would be at or near the top of the list, especially since Israel has taken out almost all the other threats. So it really, it's just Iran. The question is it in America's interest to participate in that war? And make no mistake, Israel wouldn't last 3 days in a war by itself against Iran. In fact, probably not even 24 hours. Israel's population centers would be taken out by Iran's conventional weapons. And at that point, the Israeli government could either nuke Iran, starting a chain reaction that, you know, you can't really predict once it begins, or allow hundreds of thousands of its own citizens, certainly tens of thousands, to be killed. So Israel could not do it alone, and no honest person suggests or would suggest that it could. It needs the United States. So the question from the American perspective is it good for America to get involved in yet another Israel-inspired regime change war in the Middle East? There have been quite a few, most notably Iraq. Is that a good idea? And so that debate began, and it mostly began behind the scenes. It didn't sort of peek out into public view very often, but when it did, the people who wanted the regime change war against Iran, almost, with almost zero exceptions, almost never admitted what they actually wanted, and they certainly never acknowledged what the debate was actually about. It was about one nation's interest versus another nation's interest. Do those interests convene? Are they the same thing? Or are they at odds with each other? I can see what would be a good idea for Israel to want this. Is it a good idea for us? That's the debate that never took place. And it didn't take place because almost from the beginning, the people who wanted regime change war with Iran made the debate instead about, why do you hate the Jews? You're a Nazi. And of course, that was never what the debate was about, because Israel, the nation of Israel, the one with the parliament, the Knesset, and the military, the IDF, and lots of people and tech firms, and is not, by the way, exclusively Jewish, and it isn't actually the same as all Jews in the world at all. And in fact, there are a lot of Jews around the world who have mixed feelings about Israel or certainly don't want a regime change war in Iran. But the people who do want that in the United States, Israel's proxies in the United States, its defenders, its professional defenders in the U.S., immediately made the debate about the Jews. It wasn't the anti-Semites who did that, actually. It was the defenders of Israel in the United States, not all of whom are Jewish, to be clear. They're the ones who made the debate from the first day, why do you hate the Jews? And so for those who were hesitant to get into another regime change war, it's intimidating because you're happy to have a debate any time of day about what's in the interest of the United States. When should we project military force? What can we learn from the last 25 years, et cetera, et cetera. And you'd probably win that debate because there's no evidence that any regime change war we've engaged in the past couple of generations has helped us. Zero evidence. And everyone kind of knows that, including the president of the United States. But if you make it a debate about why do you hate the Jews, then most people are going to opt out because they don't want to deal with it. Most of them don't hate the Jews. You hope. no evidence that they do, but nobody wants to be tarred as a bigot. And so very few people pushed back, very few. In fact, as far as I know, only two people, me and Charlie Kirk, actually went and spoke directly to the president to make the case that, no, you shouldn't get involved in this war because its aim is not actually to deny Iran a nuclear weapon. That may be a virtuous goal, but that's not really what this is about. What this is about is luring the United States into yet another regime change war. And if you do that, it's bad for everybody, including you. That's the case that we made. Charlie went to the White House to make that case, and God bless him for doing that. And he was hated for doing that. But he did it. Very few other people did. In fact, as far as I know, none. So, of course, in June, the debate ended, and the United States did commit military force to Iran. It bombed Iran and spent billions to protect Israel once again from the inevitable, the predictable conventional response from Iran, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, thank God, we did not get lured into a regime change war. But the bitterness lingered, and the total unwillingness of the people pushing for that war to state their aims, to be honest about what they wanted, and to defend what they wanted, remained. They understood from the very first day that they could not win that debate. They didn't want that debate. They wanted another debate where they felt they could win, or at least cow their opponents into total silence. And that debate was about, quote, the Jews, anti-Semitism. And again, this is a country that hasn't had a lot of anti-Semitism. Decent people are not anti-Semitic. Christians understand that anti-Semitic behavior or thoughts, attitudes are unchristian because Christians are universalist in their thinking. Every person has the capacity to come to God through Jesus. Every person, no matter how they were born. And so, of course, no sincere Christian could be an anti-Semite, and no sincere Christian would ever defend anti-Semitism. In fact, he would call it out as he would racism or any form of discrimination on the basis of blood. He would call it out immediately. So this was never about anti-Semitism, despite the fact there, of course, are anti-Semites and all kinds of other people in this country. There are 350 million of them. But this debate was not about the Jews or anti-Semitism. It was about when to use military force and to what extent should you follow the lead of a much smaller nation as you think about your own nation. And for a lot of people, this was enormously frustrating since Donald Trump was elected for the second time last November on a platform that explicitly promised, and this is why he was elected, to help the United States, which is in tough shape and getting worse. And everybody knows that.
As the discussion intensifies, understanding Mark Levin's controversial statements and the hostility he invokes against opponents is crucial. These sentiments reflect a broader trend toward divisive rhetoric. In the upcoming segment, the focus shifts to personal accountability in the face of such vitriol as the speaker confronts their own reactions and the dangers of becoming what they despise.
And I disagree with that, and I have contempt for it. But rather than say that, I just attacked in a vicious way Liz Cheney. And I said something awful about Liz Cheney, actually. Didn't explain why I was mad at Liz Cheney. I just slandered Liz Cheney, basically. And I said that her father would be ashamed of her, and if I had a daughter like that, I'd probably kill myself, which is an awful thing to say. It's kind of hard to believe I said that. But in my mind, I was thinking of all the people I dislike, Liz Cheney would probably be at the top of the list. And so therefore, because I dislike her personally, because I know her personally, and because I so disagree with everything about her political views, I'm the opposite of Liz Cheney. If you were to graph it out, I'd be on one side, Liz Cheney would be the other. Because we disagree so profoundly, I told myself, clearly I must have told myself, that you could say anything you want about Liz Cheney. She's not really human. You can say anything you want, including something really awful and nasty, like if I was her dad, I would kill myself. Who thinks like that? Who talks like that? Well, I did. And so I just want to say I'm sorry to Liz Cheney, and I mean that too. I mean that. I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry I said that. I will not stop disagreeing with Liz Cheney until she changes her views. I hope that she does. But there is never an excuse to talk about people like that. That kind of is the trap here. Mark Levin is almost 70 years old. You know, I mean, no one's going to eat the dog food here, okay? That is not a message anyone's going to buy. So the fear is not that Mark Levin will take over American politics. That's not going to happen. The fear is that we become Mark Levin. By staring at Mark Levin too much, we become him. Another way of putting it is the fight is not against Mark Levin and the many Mark Levins out there, the screamers, the slanderers, the impugners of character, the liars. The real fight is within ourselves. The real fight is against our own nature, our own natural inclination to, in the face of Mark Levin, become Mark Levin. And the cost is to us. You hurt yourself. Don't become evil. Because what's the point? What is the point? And the only way to prevent yourself from becoming that person is by admitting that you've acted like that person and apologizing for it sincerely, not in a fake way. Oh, I'm sorry if you didn't like it. No, I'm sorry, because that's wrong. And it's exactly what I don't like about someone else. And I don't like it about myself when I do it. And I'm going to try not to do it again. And of course, I will do it. Probably by the end of the show, I'll do it again. Because I'm prone to that, because I get mad. But we need to say every single time we do that, no, I'm sorry I did that. And I'll try my best not to do it again. So really, just to keep in mind, as things heat up, don't become the people you despise, or else what's the point? You wind up, I mean, the Second World War is that story. We're fighting for freedom, but we're arming Joseph Stalin to do it. Really, we sent more money and airplanes and tanks and jeeps and boots and food to Joseph Stalin, the greatest mass murderer in history, in order to bring what? Freedom to the world? It's not a defense of Hitler, of course, but that's shameful. The Roosevelt administration did that with the full support of his party. It's like, don't become the thing that you hate. That's it. And if you don't do that, if you allow yourself to get carried away, so mad that you start mimicking the hate that's coming at you, what happens? Well, of course, it flowers into violence. Like, that's inevitable. We're very close to that now. In fact, we're there in some ways. It's happened. We're still talking about a political assassination, a friend's political assassination on September 10th. Charlie Kirk was murdered because of this. So it can happen, and it will happen, unless all of us prevent ourselves from becoming that. And by the way, you can't control other people. All you can do is control your own behavior. So if you act like that, apologize for it. I'm going to really try and do that. But we are absolutely moving toward violence, and it should be really clear. That's the other thing, is you don't want to espouse violence, because where does it go? It always begets more violence 100% of the time. September 11th led to millions of deaths in the Middle East. Yeah. October 7th led to Gaza. Like, this all, once the violence begins, you can't predict its course, but you can be fairly certain it will accelerate. And when that happens, all calculations change and people change. And the feud becomes irresolvable and more people die. And that could happen in our country. So the only way to stop it is by controlling your own behavior so you yourself don't become evil. So Mark Levin is already there. And we know that because Mark Levin has repeatedly, and he's not the only one, but he's the most blunt, has repeatedly called for just murdering civilians, children in Gaza, because they're Amalek or whatever. They're stained by blood guilt. Prime Minister of Israel said exactly the same thing. They are guilty by virtue of how they were born. So that, by definition, includes women and children. So Mark Levin is not clever enough to keep the implications of these views to himself, and he said them repeatedly on television, just to give you a sense about how Mark Levin feels about human life and the human soul. Watch this.
And I'm supposed to, what, shed crocodile tears for what's going to happen to these people? I'm not. Maybe I'm the only one who will voice it, but I'm not. Israel has every right to throw every damn thing it has at barbarians. And if there are innocent people, quote-unquote civilians, who are killed, then maybe they ought to organize to take out the government they elected. Tapper and the others are saying there's 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. They're not all terrorists. They don't all believe in Hamas. They really have no choice. Let me ask you a question. Is that how we treated the German people when we were fighting the Third Reich? Well, they're not all Nazis. I mean, you got to fight to win and survive. You can't sit there and figure all that stuff out. Oh, but don't hurt the civilians. Look, we have to defend ourselves. The Israelis have to defend ourselves. The free world has to defend itself. And if there's collateral damage, well, that's too bad.
25 years ago in this country, people didn't talk that way. They didn't. It was a different landscape, different expectations. The idea of blood guilt, because that's what he's describing there. You should be killed by virtue of who your parents are, who your grandparents were, by virtue of how you were born. You should be killed. You don't have a right to live. You're guilty because you were born, which of course leads to collective punishment and genocide. That's the basis of genocide right there, that attitude. That was considered totally un-Christian and un-American, because it is. And if someone said something like that on television, I mean, he'd be probably pulled off the air for that. You should kill kids because you don't like their parents? That is their attitude. That's the Israeli government's attitude. Well-documented attitude. We're paying for that. And you could say, well, you know, you don't have to hate Israel, but that behavior is not better than Hamas at all. In fact, it's kind of the same, right? Killed civilians. They came in and killed people at a music festival. Bibi, turns out, let them in. We found out today in the Knesset. But whatever you think of what happened on October 7th, you know, Israeli civilians were killed. That's terrible. We're against that. We have to be against that. And we're no better than the people we're fighting, of course. What is the difference between us and them? We're in different groups? That's not a meaningful difference. The difference is we're committed to a set of Western principles. And those principles begin with, we reject blood guilt. And because we do, we reject collective punishment and genocide. A lot of us thought that was a consensus after World War II. That was the lesson of the Nazi regime. Should have been the lesson of the Soviet regime, which of course practiced collective punishment and committed genocide against Christians.
Understanding the implications of labeling others as Nazis is crucial here, as it leads to dangerous rhetoric and can incite violence. This mentality reflects broader issues within political discourse. Now, let's delve into how this controversy shapes our conversations about responsibility and American priorities in the ongoing debate about foreign influence.
Because once you start calling people Nazis, we really have no choice but to start shooting them. To be Dietrich Bonhoeffer and sort of reach the end of reason or even Christianity. Bonhoeffer decided Christianity's not even, he's a Lutheran pastor. Christianity's not enough. We have to kill the guy. I'm not judging Bonhoeffer, who was a great man in some ways, but that's inevitable once we decide that people are Nazis. So you kind of have to wonder why they're doing this. And of course, it's because when you call someone a Nazi, and maybe in Mark Levin's case, he believes it, you immediately freeze them in the headlights of your slur. Nazi? Nazi? You deter people from arguing with you because no one wants to be called a Nazi. But you also, for the bystanders who aren't even directly part of the debate, you draw their attention away from what the debate is actually about. In other words, for every moment that we're arguing about who is and who is not a Nazi, answer really nobody. The Nazi's been gone for 80 years, sorry. But for every moment where they're having that debate, we're not debating the things we ought to be debating. In this case, should we use military force on behalf of a small country, a totally irrelevant country? That's a fair debate. We're not having that debate. We're screaming about who is not a is a Nazi, who's not a Nazi. So I guess the thing that we can learn from Mark Levin in this case is if you have a position, argue that position. Levin doesn't want to argue his position. It's very hard to defend, so he won't defend it. He'll just attack. But the rest of us who have a sincere position about America's relationship with Israel and the damage it has done to the Trump coalition, which it's like, we're watching it be destroyed, very unfortunately. Those people should argue what they believe and not get caught in this trap of identity politics. Who's a Nazi was a right to speak? Buzz off. No. AIPAC is a foreign lobby. It should register as one. Our country should come first in the thinking of every person represents our country. Those are the debates that we ought to be having. So the next lesson that we should learn from this contretemps is that you can't allow other people to define your priorities. You are an adult. You are an American. You have the right to decide what matters to you. If you're having trouble paying your health insurance, or if you think divorce laws are unfair in this country, or if you think chemtrails are a problem, if you don't like fluoride in the water, if you think there should be a cap on credit card interest, whatever the issue that matters to you, first and foremost, you have a right to feel that way. No one should be allowed to talk you into adopting their enemies as your own. There are a ton of people in Washington who think the single most dangerous person in the world, most evil person who's ever lived is Vladimir Putin. Some of them really think that. A lot of them are getting rich by saying it, but a lot of them do believe it because I know them. I know they feel that way. It's sincere. But as a percentage of the country, what percentage of the country actually puts killing Putin at the top of its priority list? Like, less than 1%. It's just not a problem for most Americans who runs Russia. But it's a huge problem in Washington. So Washington, for a couple of years there, succeeded in convincing the rest of us to either adopt their priority, Putin is the most important thing, we have to stop Putin, or shut up about it because if you don't, you're an agent of Putin. Basically bullied the country into accepting their list of priorities. And the election of Trump was really a refutation of that. It was tens of millions of voters saying, no, actually, our problems need a hearing. Someone needs to care about our problems. It's not just about you and your little parochial squabble. They're telling us now that Iran is the biggest problem we've ever had. And if you question that, like how many Americans have been killed on American soil by Iran as compared to the number, I don't know, killed by Mexico, which brings all our fentanyl in, not Venezuela, Mexico, you get attacked as an agent of the mullahs. And the way to think about this is, who cares? Your priorities are every bit as important as Mark Levin's, because you are a co-equal with Mark Levin because you're also an American citizen. He gets one vote, you get one vote. That's our system. So Mark Levin can scream at you all he wants and tell you you must really care about affecting regime change in Iran. It is absolutely okay. In fact, it's your duty to say to Mark Levin, I don't really care. I can't afford my health insurance. Our leader should solve that problem. And you'll be joined in that by like 150 million other Americans who agree with you, who can't find Iran on a map. They're not pro-Iran. They're not Shiite Muslims. But they have real problems and they want a hearing for those problems. They want someone else to care about those problems. It's okay. And it's interesting because people like Levin and Ben Shapiro, who at one point had this like media empire propped up by Facebook, The Daily Wire, with some good people on it, you know, it's fine. It's fine. But Ben Shapiro spent, I don't know, a decade posing as someone who actually cared about your concerns as an American. He did it imperfectly. There were flashes that he didn't really care. But he's like, no, I'm a conservative. I'm a conservative. I'm not just interested in the fortunes of one tiny country in the Middle East with a population of 9 million. No, I have a lot of interest. I really care about this country and I'm against the trans movement or whatever. But increasingly, as everyone's gotten more hysterical and prone to sort of blurting out the truth, that veil has dropped and you can see what Ben Shapiro really, really cares about. So this is a very revealing exchange that took place 6 days ago, last Thursday, on stage with Megyn Kelly. Ben Shapiro was just sitting there being interviewed by Megyn Kelly and said something like, well, Tucker Carlson's, you know, for Maduro, the communist leader of Venezuela, who were, I guess, were on the way to killing or something, forcing out, regime changing him. And he defended Maduro. Didn't, actually. And Megyn Kelly says, well, Tucker said in his show that Maduro, most people didn't know this, whatever his many faults, I wouldn't hire him as an economist, okay? But whatever his many faults, has the most socially conservative country probably in the hemisphere. So Venezuela is just a fact. I mean, I didn't make this up. I'm not in charge of Venezuela. Just noticing that Venezuela has banned pornography, banned abortion, banned gay marriage, banned sex changes, and banned usury. You don't have credit cards with 40% interest in Venezuela. Okay. Ben Shapiro responded this way.
Tucker's made the point, I'm not going to here to be Tucker's defender, but he's made the point that Maduro is culturally conservative.
Who gives a shit? The guy's a communist dictator. Everyone in his country is eating dog. He's shipping fentanyl to the United States to kill Americans. Why do I give a shit whether he's anti-LGBTQ rights?
Who gives a shit? I do. I'm not moving to Venezuela. I'm not pro-Maduro. But I care about that. Why wouldn't I care about that? I've got kids. Like, first of all, I'm against abortion. Sorry. Unpopular. I feel that way. I think it's really sad. I would personally become poorer to end abortion, voluntarily become poorer to end abortion in the United States. That's not a choice. Don't want to become poorer, but I would because I care about it. Maybe you don't. Maybe you're offended that I do, but I care about it. Lots of people care about it. I don't think pornography is good. That really hurts people. You know, I don't think pretending that the sexes are the same is good. And you claimed that you didn't think it was good, but it turns out, quote, I don't give a shit. Maduro's against Israel. Oh, okay. I don't give a shit. Well, you spent like a decade pretending you did give a shit, that you were on the side of like normal Americans who have a mix of concerns. They definitely care about economics and they care about social issues too because they have children and they see where this is going. It's not good. That your economic condition is not the only measure of health. Your spiritual condition matters too. It's just a fact. It does. If you're totally degraded, it doesn't matter how much money you have. It's not worth it. It's not worth getting the whole world and losing your souls.
While discussing the deep economic divides and the moral implications of leaders underestimating ordinary Americans, a powerful thread of contempt emerges. This notion sets the stage for the next segment, where a heartfelt dialogue unfolds between Tucker and Anna Kasparian, emphasizing the need for empathy and understanding amid harsh rhetoric.
Being reunited to another person, discovering that actually, I really like you. I thought I didn't, but now I do. Because there are no permanent enemies. We have to have that attitude. And it's with that in mind that I announce with sincere pleasure that I really like and respect Anna Kasparian. And not because both of us have total contempt for the lunatic running Israel right now, Bibi Netanyahu, but because I sincerely think that Anna Kasparian, while she disagrees with me, I'm sure, on a million issues, is motivated by a desire to figure out what is best for the country that we live in. It's not about Israel at all. Sorry, Mark Levin. It's about us. And I think Anna Kasparian really cares about the United States. And so with that in mind, I'm just very happy to introduce her now. Anna, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Tucker. I appreciate it.
I'm worried about where this is going. I'm worried about all the Nazi talk, not just because it's directed at me and you, but because once you start talking like that, it's kind of hard to walk it back, and it's kind of hard to disapprove of violence when the people you're calling Hitler get killed. Like, how could you be sad when Hitler dies? So how do we, where are we going, and how do we stop the introduction of, like, Nazi, Hitler, fascist into our conversation? We need to pull back on that, I think.
Well, I obviously you're right about that. There's no question. And I think what you're also correct about is the fact that these words are specifically being used in a way to intimidate people and persuade them to avoid speaking out against what they find to be a huge problem in our country's priorities right now. And what I would like to say to anyone who's been smeared as an anti-Semite when they don't have any hatred in their hearts at all for the Jewish people is don't let them win when they do that to you, because you know in your heart you're not an anti-Semite. You know in your heart that you're not a Nazi. The people closest to you in your life know that. And so you as an American have every right in the world to be critical of the fact that regardless of which presidential administration we're talking about, our priorities are messed up, and there isn't enough focus on all the various aspects of American society that are completely falling apart right now as we speak. You know, there's been political violence in this country. I'm going to put my cards on the table and say, you know, I've been guilty of using inflammatory rhetoric, certainly. But I think what you're saying here is important, especially as it pertains to how Americans communicate with one another about these incredibly controversial issue. I get that people get passionate, but you have to understand the motivations of the person who's trying to smear you, number one. Number two, if you are met with this type of rhetoric from a fellow American, you're so right. Do not become what you claim to hate. Don't become hateful yourself. I allowed that to happen to me to some extent during Trump's first term. I have a lot of remorse about that because I think there are a lot of really great people in this country. They voted for Trump. Turns out I don't care. It doesn't matter who they voted for. It doesn't say anything about who they are as people. And more importantly, they're my fellow Americans who have participated in what makes this country great, which is our ability to voice our support and cast our ballot for who we feel is best to represent us. So I just think there's something kind of interesting happening in the country right now that gives me a little bit of optimism, gives me a little bit of hope. People are starting to see beyond partisanship and instead kind of understand, okay, wait a minute, we're all Americans. It feels like a lot of the framing around partisan divides is completely manufactured and in fact is utilized by members of the media to divide us and to distract us from the fact that our government is not focused on taking care of us. And so I just really want to drive that point home. Don't fall for the gross rhetoric. Don't partake in it. And try to see the humanity in everyone before you allow yourself to devolve into the very thing that you hate. Now, I will say it's really hard for me to practice that when it comes to members of the IDF and Netanyahu in particular. But I think your message is the correct message.
So I saw this. I've been brooding about this for the last couple of days because I am worried that the violence will accelerate. I've been in countries where this happens. It gets to a certain point and, you know, your cousin gets killed. And at that point, you can't think clearly and you just, you know, you get swept up in it. That is a very familiar cycle to anyone who's seen it. So the only way to stop that is by controlling our own behavior and by being honest about it. And as I was thinking about this, I saw that you apologized to someone publicly for something that you had said about him. And I just, oh, it was weird that we were having the same thoughts at the same time. But can you explain that?
Sure. So about 5 years ago, Aaron Mate, who is a journalist and is actually doing a lot of really great work, especially in his coverage of what's happening in Gaza, had reported some things that I disagreed with in regard to what was happening in Syria, right? So he didn't deny that Bashar al-Assad had, in some instances, used chemical weapons, but there was one particular instance that he was denying, and I disagreed with him on that. Who's right, who's wrong, that doesn't even matter at this point. I don't even know why I allowed that one minor disagreement to basically whip me up into this crazy frenzy and this
been idea. There, baby.
All of a sudden, I'm like, no, Aaron Maté, definitely, he's getting funded by the Russians. And so on TYT one day, Cenk and I were discussing Syria, and I just blurted that out. And, you know, I was in a different headspace at that time. I'd like to think that I've matured a little bit since then. And I just kept doubling down. I wouldn't apologize. There were some circumstantial things that I would point to, but really nothing solid to prove that Aaron Maté is funded by the Russians. And so over the last year in particular, I just kept seeing his posts on X. I actually was on a panel with him on Piers Morgan's show, and he and I were very much on the same page in regard to the topic we were discussing. And every single time he would come up in my mind, I've just felt really bad about myself because I smeared him. And I never apologized, and that's not okay. And so I came across another one of his posts today that I liked on X, and I was like, you know what? Now is the time. It's been 5 years. It's embarrassing that it's been 5 years. Now is the time for me to practice what I preach, to lead by example and apologize to him unequivocally. And I was met with grace. He was very, very kind, and he accepted my apology, and I'm very grateful for that. But there's another point I want to just quickly make about this. If you are in the media, understand, like, we are all flawed, and you're right, Tucker, we all do change, some for the better, some for the worse. It is okay to admit when you're wrong. It is okay to apologize. It doesn't make you, I don't know, a less credible person if you admit you were wrong.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.